proceed to the next case of the morning. In re Dolly's Playhouse. Mr. Blood.
Thank you, Your Honor. I represent Dolly's Playhouse in an adversary complaint arising out of a bankruptcy proceeding. The complaint is at, well, in this appeal, Your Honors, we're asking this court to reverse a res judicata-based judgment against Dolly's and to allow it to proceed in its adversary complaint against the appellee, Naval Excavating. My presentation will be brief. There are two sentences that I would like to draw this court's attention to in the red brief on page 26. And there it says, in the second full paragraph, certainly, based on Dolly's own pleadings, there is no question that Dolly's knew of Nabel's claim of ownership of the real estate well before Dolly's filed its complaint in the state court proceedings. As a result, there is no question that Dolly's knew or should have known of its alleged cause of action against Nathan Eggemeyer well before it filed its state court claim. The point of my presentation today, Your Honors, is that that is not true, and I think that that's where the dogfight is in this appeal.
But, you know, there's already something I would like to point out here, which
Your
is
Honor.
That obviously we're under the regime of 28 U.S.C. Section 1738. We're looking at what preclusive effect would Illinois give to the prior judgment, and we know that since 1998, when the Supreme Court of Illinois decided the River Park case, that Illinois, like actually the federal courts, uses a transactional approach to claim preclusion. So knowledge of a claim is kind of a secondary question. At the time the state court action was filed, this action is out of the same transaction or occurrence. Now, whether the statute of limitations had run, whether you knew about it, whether there was some discovery rule, whether all sorts of other things are further down the line. If you were suing about a transaction or occurrence, according to Illinois, the judgment in that case resolves all things that arise out of that transaction or occurrence, unless you can find an Illinois-based exception to the law of claim preclusion.
Well, Your Honor, I think that's well taken. Certainly,
so where does Illinois say there's no claim preclusion if once you're litigating, you failed to realize or you didn't have facts at your disposal that you might have had another count, you know, that you could have added to the complaint?
Well, I think it's a great understatement to say that this is just another count or just another theory, Your Honor.
Well, but it is. I mean, it is another theory. Now, of course, the underlying facts of what goes on in this case are terrible.
It's quite a story.
Yeah, there's definitely quite a story. We can all recognize that. But the first lawsuit was about whether there was, in fact, an agreement at the end of the 30, you know, whatever it was, upon the payment of the $300,000 to transfer title, or whether it was really just a lease, and the Illinois court decides it's a lease, the Illinois appellate court affirms. And this is really about the same thing. It's about a corporate opportunity, you know, who was going to buy the property, and some of the more ghastly facts in the case don't seem to come up in either one of these claims.
You see, Your Honor, something happened during the state court litigation that surprised us. That surprised, I wasn't counsel then, but that surprised Dolly's. A lease appeared in discovery from Nabel. Nabel produced a lease. That is the lease that the circuit court referred to, the state trial court referred to, that the state appellate court referred to. That lease controlled the relationship between the parties. And that lease is dated 1995. Here we have a litigation that's begun in 1999. How could Dolly's not know about that lease? It doesn't make sense. How could Dolly's not know? Well.
But your main point is you've said it appeared during the state court litigation.
During discovery,
yes. The courts of Illinois, just like the courts of any other jurisdiction I'm familiar with, have provisions under which you can amend complaints. You know, you can try, you can at least present to the state court. And if the state court refused to hear the case. At that point, you might say, well, the state court itself has drawn a line and has said this other subject matter is not part of the case.
Oh, I agree with that.
But you had the opportunity to raise any issues pertaining to that lease, whether it's issues about where did this lease come from or anything else that you wanted to. You should have said something, or I don't mean you personally, of course, but the way the system is supposed to work is that litigant, through whatever agent it chooses, is supposed to bring that to the attention of the first court.
I have given that very question a great deal of thought, Your Honor, and it's somewhat difficult to reconstruct, but I've done so to my own satisfaction, and I hope to the satisfaction of this court.
Okay.
Why didn't Dolly's just amend its state court claim? And the answer is, as far as I can tell, that there was a 100% turnover of Dolly's board and of Dolly's counsel between the time that lease is dated, and I'm not saying signed because I don't think it was signed on the date it's dated. I think it was much later. But the date on the lease to the date that lease appeared in discovery, there had been 100% turnover of the relevant personnel. And the effect of that lease was our hearts sank. Our confidence was at about an 8. When that lease appeared, it was about a 1.5. But it wasn't until later when people started to say, stop saying, why didn't you show me that before? And started to say, oh, you never saw it either. Oh, we've been had. We have been had. We've been swindled. We've been hornswoggled. Who signed that lease? The murderer, you know who I'm talking about. And his president, his corporate president, Puppet, the fellow who said, I didn't even know that that existed. I signed what I'm told to sign. It was a trick. And it took a while for the personnel on Dolly's side to get that together. And the reason they didn't get it together sooner is the timing of the dropping of the lease on the table, which Dolly's couldn't control because Dolly's didn't even know it existed. Hegemeyer did that. And he's taking advantage of it. He's taking advantage of it in the district court, in the bankruptcy court, and he's taking advantage of it today in Chicago. That's the trick. He took advantage of us. And he may very well get away with it.
That's where you need to find some provision of Illinois preclusion law that says, you know, some case or something that says under these circumstances the courts of Illinois would not apply preclusion, because it's definitely not because it isn't the same transaction. It isn't because it all ultimately arises out of the same things. And you need, I don't know whether they have a fraud exception, whatever. You haven't told us why preclusion doesn't apply in this corporate to corporate, I mean, there's a lot of veil piercing going on here as well that we're seeing kind of back and forth. At one moment we're talking about Hegemeyer, and the next moment we're talking about the corporation. So,
Your Honor, the cases all say that res judicata is an equitable doctrine. One requests it, as one requests equitable relief, and that it shall not be used contrary to the interest of justice. A specific case? No, I've got to admit that I've never seen a case where anyone's tried anything like what Mr. Hegemeyer did. I could spend all day talking about that, but the point is, in the interest of justice, is this party really in a position to say we deserve equitable relief? Or my goodness, we'll be forced to do things twice in court? Is that so horrible? You know what Hegemeyer did to Dolly's. You know that. And is this court, just like every other court that's heard this so far, and going to say the interest of justice means nothing? Doesn't mean a thing.
Well, that's but just what cases. This case is about is who owns the property, though. This case is not about who murdered somebody, and this case isn't about problems between the owners of Dolly's and the owners of Nabel. It's about who owns the property, because had the corporate opportunity, under your theory, been presented to Dolly's, Dolly's would have been the owner.
If Masters hadn't died, this would all have been put together very quickly.
Well, I mean, but that's a collateral question, really.
It is. It's interesting, but collateral, yes. I don't really have a rebuttal anymore.
Okay.
I'd just ask the court to consider the briefs because whatever Mr. Johnson says, I will not be able to respond to.
Well, you've still got half a minute, so sit down and you come back. Okay, Mr. Johnson.
May it please the court. My name is P.K. Johnson V. I represent Appalee Naval Excavating, Inc. My argument, I want to focus on something that I did focus on in my brief, but I don't think I focused on enough, and that's the factual overlap between Dolly's state court claim and Dolly's bankruptcy court claim. As your honors know, in the state court, Dolly's filed a petition or complaint for declaratory judgment, asking the court to declare that Dolly's was the owner of this property. As your honors also know, NABL produced a lease at the state court trial that was signed by Nathan Eggemeyer on behalf of Dolly's and which was signed by William Trollinger on behalf of NABL. And contrary to what's in their brief, Dolly's did not receive this brief in November 2001 like they state. In fact, if you look at the record and you look at Dolly's, I think it's their memorandum in opposition to NABL's motion to dismiss, they state that they received this lease in May of 2001, so a year before the trial. And they also attached to that memorandum our supplemental request for production, which establishes that they did know about this lease almost a year before the trial, not 6 months before the trial. Nevertheless, NABL did introduce this written lease, and it was at that time that Dolly's should have attacked this lease. The issue in the trial court, was this a valid lease? Was this a valid real estate transaction?
Well, at a minimum, I assume the lease would have indicated that it was NABL that owned the land. I mean, NABL's the lessor, right?
Right.
So that much is clear.
I don't think there was ever a question that NABL did own the land and that they did purchase the land. Dolly's never disputed that. The whole dispute was, did Dolly's and NABL agree that after Dolly's made payments to NABL for 5 years, was Dolly's then going to own the land?
You know, it's a very strange transaction. If the land was $30,000 and Dolly's is going to pay $300,000 for it, how does that come about?
Very strange transaction. I agree. But you have to remember that this was a business that was making a whole lot of money at the time.
Yeah, but why would you agree to pay a tenfold increase? That's quite an appreciation rate over a three-year or so period.
Something that was brought up at the trial court. Something that my witnesses were asked on cross-examination, why would somebody do that? Again, we're back to the res judicata argument. We're talking about the merits of this case now. And this was all addressed at the trial court. Shouldn't be addressed again in the bankruptcy court.
Well, as I understand your opponent's argument, it sounds to me like he's making kind of a fraudulent concealment argument somehow, that you couldn't be expected to raise a claim in the earlier litigation that was concealed from you, and thus Illinois might recognize that as an exception to claim preclusion.
I'm trying to figure out what was concealed. They had the lease a year before the trial. It wasn't something that was dropped off in their laps the day before or the time of trial. They had the lease a year before the trial. I gave it to them the day that I got it. I'm not sure what they're claiming that was concealed. And again, if they're claiming that something was concealed, wasn't the time to bring that up in the trial court when they're attacking this whole real estate transaction? They're claiming that Dolly's, not NABL, should own this real estate. That would be the first thing that I would bring up. Look, we were defrauded. NABL should not be the owner of this property. Dolly's should be the owner. And they did bring that up in the trial court. They admitted into evidence. They asked the court to take judicial notice of the fact that Nathan Eggemeyer murdered Stephen Masters. They asked the court to take judicial notice of the fact that Nathan Eggemeyer then sued Stephen Masters after he did
Nathan
so.
Nathan Eggemeyer doesn't have any continuing interest in NABL, does it?
No, Nathan Eggemeyer is in prison.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So he's out of the picture. And it's his sons who are?
It's not. It's his parents.
His parents, okay.
Right. And Nathan Eggemeyer, and that was always was one of the arguments in the trial court, Nathan Eggemeyer never had any legal ownership interest in NABL to begin with. It was owned, and the director and the sole officer was a gentleman by the name of William Prowlinger. But again, we're arguing the merits of the case, the same thing that I've argued in the trial court, in the state appellate court, in bankruptcy court. It's the same stuff over and over and over again. And I would challenge Mr. Blood to point out one fact to me that hasn't already been raised in the trial court or in the appellate court, because he can't do it. They're going to call, if this proceeds to trial, they're going to call the same witnesses, George Marifian, who is the attorney for both Nabil and Dolly's. They're going to call William Trollinger. They're going to call Nathan Eggemeyer. They're going to call the exact same witnesses to testify to the exact same things about this real estate transaction. And in response, I'm going to call the exact same witnesses and introduce the exact same evidence that there was a lease, that the Dolly's knew about this lease, and again, everything is going to be exactly the same. And I think the language from one of the cases that I cited states that the principle of res judicata is founded upon the plainest and most substantial justice, that litigation should have an end, and that no person should be unnecessarily harassed with a multiplicity of suits. And that's exactly what's happening here. I would ask that this court affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Blood, you do have a little time if you want to say something.
Appreciate that, Your Honor.
When we found out about the lease, Board Member Koopman was new since the date of the lease. Board Member Mrs. Masters, the widow, knew. Attorney Gary Peel, who tried the case, knew. He was brand new. Who knew that this lease hadn't shown up before? Who knew it wasn't in Dolly's books? I mean, at that point, it was internal finger-pointing. I would suggest to this court that although someone might have put it all together at that point, it certainly would have been anybody with my mental capacity. Hindsight's plenty good. In hindsight, why? Why? But if you look at the evidence that was available to Dolly's and Dolly's counsel then, this makes sense. Murder may pay. You know, murder may pay. It doesn't pay in the criminal court, but it just may pay at the bank. I appreciate the hearing very much, and we ask for reversal.
Thanks very much. Thanks to both counsel.